corporate ideologues never cease blathering that government programs should be run like a business. Really? What business would they choose? Pharmaceutical profiteers? Big oil? Wall Street money manipulators? High-tech billionaires? Airline price gougers? The good news is that the great majority of people aren't buying this corporate blather. Instead, valuing institutions that prioritize the common good. Thus, by a 2-to-1 margin, Americans have stunned smug right-wing privatizers by specifically declaring in a recent poll that our U.S. Postal Service should not be run like a business. Indeed, an overwhelming majority, including half of Republicans, say mail delivery should be run as a, quote, public service, even if that costs more. In fact, having proven that this 246-year-old federal agency can consistently and efficiently deliver to 161 million homes and businesses day after day, it's time to let the agency's trusted, decentralized, well-trained workforce provide even more services for our communities. How about postal banking? Yes, the existing network of some 31,000 post offices in metro neighborhoods and small towns across America are perfectly situated and able to provide basic banking services to the 1 out of 4 of us who don't have or can't afford bank accounts. The giant banking chains ignore these millions, leaving them at the mercy of check-cashing exploiters and payday loan sharks. The post office can offer simple, honest banking, including small-dollar checking and savings accounts, very low-interest consumer loans, low-fee debit cards, etc. The goal of postal banking is not to maximize corporate profits, but public service. This is Jim Hightower saying, we the people own this public asset. To enable it to work even better for us, go to agrandalliance.org. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a recently released report by the folks at Greenpeace USA shows, I think, what we already know. You got a handful of multinational corporations who are boogering up the planet, mostly looking at Coke, Pepsi, and Nestle. Nestle doesn't get as much attention as they should, even though they're one of the largest water companies in the world, making sure that they sell us enough water. And what they've done over the last several decades, expand plastic production to feed our need for bottled water and other things. That's why I've asked Graham Forbes to come talk with us. Graham is Greenpeace's global plastics project leader. He's also the lead on this report titled The Climate Emergency Unpacked, How Consumer Goods Companies Are Fueling Big Oil's Plastic Expansion. Graham, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great to be with you, Rick.
I'm looking at this and I'm going, when I was a kid, you had drinking fountains everywhere. The thought of buying a bottle of water, something completely out of bounds. And I remember when bottled water came out, I'm going, why? You got drinking fountains. Yet it has become the dominant thing in our society. And it's horrible for our planet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the reality is that plastic, single-use plastic, bottled water is really killing us. And I think this report, a lot of people are sort of growing awareness around the plastic pollution crisis. We've seen the pictures of the turtles and the sea life being sort of damaged and killed by this plastic. But what folks don't really know is that all of that comes from fossil fuels and it comes from oil and gas. And companies like ExxonMobil and Shell are really looking to expand that production dramatically to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars over the next few years.
So if we're not going to use plastic, what do we use? I mean, we've gotten our kids into the reusable thing. Everyone's got a water bottle. Everybody you see walking around. When I was a kid, you never worried about, am I hydrated enough? You drank out of a garden hose for sake. But now everyone's got their bottle. And I know I sound like a curmudgeon, but it's one of these things where, do we all have to have our little bottles because we're not, able to make sure we get a drink when we can? It's weird.
Yeah. That's it. It is weird. And I think, companies like Coca-Cola, they sell you on the idea of this convenience because they get to slap their brand all over it and sort of get marketing everywhere in your face. And it's like, at the end of the day, it's not even convenient because your garbage can's filling up left and right. It's polluting communities, and it's really contributing to climate change in a really dramatic way. And I think that's one of the things that Coke doesn't want folks to know, is that as long as they're using, you know, they sell over 100 billion plastic bottles every year, and that's a huge contributor to climate change.
Now, the argument has been, Graham, that, you know, well, it's fine because we collect all those bottles. We recycle them. We're good. We're good for the environment. We're doing some recycling. The recycling is the answer, is what I'm told.
Yep. And that really, if folks might not know, recycling is sort of, plastics recycling specifically is a myth created by the oil and gas sector and companies like Coca-Cola, because what it does fundamentally is it takes the responsibility they have for producing these toxic materials and then puts it on us and puts it on local governments to clean up the mess. And the reality is we've recycled less than 9% of the plastic that's ever been produced. And there's no way we're going to recycle our way out of this crisis. And so, you know, you got a water bottle, you get a reusable water bottle, you got your kids on it. It's not that complicated. And the companies need to stop selling so much plastic.
Right. So settle a discussion between my wife and I, because I've been of the mindset for a very long time that the recycling was a bunch of nonsense just to get us to segregate our garbage. Because like you said, only a small percentage of it actually gets recycled. But she's almost like that. We got to recycle everything, and everything gets partitioned out. Is recycling helpful? Is it the answer, or is it just an exercise in futility?
Yeah, it's not the answer, and it can be useful as part of the solution. The problem is we've been having the wrong conversation for the past 50 years because that's what Coke wants to talk about, right? Like if you search Coca-Cola on plastic, you're going to get a billion words about recycling because that means they don't have to change anything. They're just going to like let you pick it up and clean it. So plastic bottles actually can be recycled, but there's all those other numbers and it's only ones and twos that actually functionally get recycled at all. And the rest of them, there's basically no market for it because China closed its doors in 2018. It gets burned or landfilled.
Yeah, and that's a terrible thing. So what is the answer here? Because, look, nobody's going to give up their Coke and Pepsi or their Dasani water or Aquafina. What is the answer? Look, I would like to go back to where there are drinking fountains around, but advocating for that during a pandemic, probably not the right answer. So where do we go?
Yeah, I mean, like most things that we need to, this is a systemic issue. It's going to require a systemic response. And so we need people to step up and vote for progressive politicians that are addressing climate change. We need to stop the massive build out of petrochemical facilities, make a just transition towards renewable energy sources. And so it's part about being politically active. And the other thing is the companies need to reform and they need to start moving towards reuse. Coke, you know, they have their freestyle machines. You can go into your local restaurant and get a billion different sodas and you don't need a plastic bottle to do it. You know, you can just put it in a cup. And so it's starting to get creative and really drawing the attention away from the sort of the absolute focus on recycling. That's just really good for their bottom line, but never going to solve the problem.
So your solution is, you know, we go into basically for-profit water fountains.
I mean, we need to do something. And I think for Coke to be a business in the future, they're going to have to transition away from plastic because the climate imperative is upon us and we need to take action and they're just not doing it.
Right. Is there any way that, because I know people, they love the convenience. You know, I'm thirsty. I'm just going to walk and I'll grab something off the shelf. Is there any way that you transform plastics into some other way, different containers? When I was a kid, you know, everything was glass bottles. We used to run around and steal people's glass bottles and then take them back to the store to get the money for them. Is that a way forward? I'm curious thoughts.
I mean, yeah, the best thing to do is reuse the valuable materials we have. So that's the starting point. But glass, paper are all less problematic than plastic. Plastic is toxic from start to finish. Extracted as oil and gas, turned into chemicals, and then, you know, it becomes waste and breaks down for the next 100 years. So our children's children get to clean up the mess. And so, yeah, part of it's going to be using other materials, but fundamentally it's just reusing materials that are more sustainable, like glass or aluminum.
Because here's the thing, and this is where I know most people, they want a clean environment. And I believe this. I've only met a couple of cranks who say, I don't care one way or another. I'll be dead before the consequences happen. Like we've stopped using plastic straws because of the turtles. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that you go, okay, we've got to do these things. But, you know, I have some friends who are like, you know, every time we turn around, we're being told something else. Every time we're being, you know, there's another part of our life that we're being told is bad. You know, how do we get past that? How do we move in a way that is more sustainable without beating ourselves up all the time?
Absolutely. I mean, this is not about personal responsibility. Like, fundamentally, it's about government stepping up to hold corporations accountable and getting corporate influence out of our democracy, which is across the board. That's a labor issue. That's an environmental issue. Right now, we have an entire party dedicated towards advancing private interests over our collective interests. And that's a huge problem. And so, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to political power.
No, that's an excellent point that you make, because, you know, you see what's going on right now. The last 4 years were some of the worst years for regulatory oversight. You had a president who was very, very clear. We're going to destroy as many regulations as possible, and we're going to transfer as much power to corporate special interest as they can. And this is the kind of thing that we end up with, because, you know, as you've pointed out, it's a policy thing. And I like the fact that you brought up that, look, we've been beating ourselves up over recycling and beating ourselves up over all this stuff when we weren't given another alternative.
That's it. And we need other alternatives. And, you know, the people that represent us need to stand up, and we need a lot less corporate money in politics.
Yeah. Do you see any, you know, look, I would love to see there be some kind of legislation, some kind of push. Do you see any of that happening in Congress right now? Is there any move to doing what you're talking about?
Yeah, there is. I mean, we have the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act. It's sort of making its way through Congress. We know it's never an easy road there, but that's a piece of legislation that puts a moratorium on petrochemical build out and does a number of other good things that help move in the right direction. And we also have the Build Back Better Act that's looking to transition away from fossil fuels more broadly and advance some of the climate interests that are going to be good for communities and ultimately be good for workers too. And I think that's where we'd like to see a lot more movement.
No, I think it's important. And for me, the idea of, you know, as we're moving away from fossil fuels and as we're moving away from a dirty economy, it then comes to the jobs that are created out of this.
Yep.
And I'm hoping that this is an opportunity that maybe we change what our economy looks like for our children so that they're not left with bad choice, the difference between bad choice and worse choice.
That's it. I mean, we need to create jobs and sustainable industries that are good jobs where workers have a voice on the job, a right to organize, collectively bargain, and start to transfer power back to people so we can actually build a middle class and stop sort of letting corporations really extract natural resources to turn a profit and leave the rest of us holding a bag, which is really a dirty planet and a lot of poverty wage jobs.
Yeah, I want to go back to a second about the bottles, because, you know, you drive along any highway, you're going to see, you know, hundreds of bottles that have been either thrown out the window or fell off the garbage truck or whatever. How bad is our plastics problem in this, not just in this country, but on this planet? How bad is the problem with as many of these single-use plastic containers that we use?
I mean, they just came out with a study where they found a bunch of microplastics in baby feces. So it's like, I mean, it's literally, it's contaminating, it's permanently, we're at risk of permanently polluting the natural environment with broken down plastic pellets. It's in our bodies, it's in our blood. I mean, we're literally surrounded by it. It's transferring disease in parts of the world. I mean, so we are, it's bad. And it's only getting worse because production, if Exxon has its way, it's going to grow production by 20 or 30% and put us in an even worse position. But I think with our report, as we start to understand it as a systemic issue, start to understand the system, we can start to make better choices and have different conversations about real solutions.
And policy choices, because look, you know, I've said for a long time, and I know I sound like just an old guy complaining about, you know, how things have changed, but the idea that we're going to buy water for more than the cost of a gallon of gas is insane. And we're going to drink it out of a container that we're going to use once and throw away that'll be here, you know, probably 100 years after I'm dead. Just seems like really not a great idea.
Spot on. It's common sense. It's a bad idea. And it doesn't pass the smell test. I mean, it's just like, it's ridiculous. Yet you still, like, I see so many commercials about recycling. Go to Coke's website and they can't talk about it enough. And it's a joke.
Yeah. But again, I think back to the, you know, when I was a kid though, you know, and this is going way back. We had the guy who was dressed up like a Native American guy with a tear coming down his eye. You know, when I found out that that was funded by corporate interests, and it wasn't an environmental ad at all, I was beyond furious.
Yes. Plastics recycling is one of the best corporate lies that's ever been told, because it makes you want to believe it because it gives you a sense of agency. But what it does under that is really transfers responsibility to you for a problem that you can never address if companies keep acting the way they are.
No, it's just and it comes back down to the money in our political system. I mean, right now we can't seem to get some sane things done that we need. We need massive investments in infrastructure, and we need even bigger investments in moving our economy to a much cleaner, more climate friendly economy. And yet we can't seem to get anything passed. So I look at what you're talking about. Of, you know, making these companies just do some sane things, and I'm going, well, that's not possible. We can't do the things we want to get done, let alone the things we don't know anything about.
I mean, that's true, Rick. We got work to do, but I think at the end of the day, we got to keep the faith and just keep pushing, because, you know, there is reason to be hopeful, because as the problem gets worse, more and more people are waking up. And the reality is the vast majority of Americans agree with these common sense changes. So there's obviously something clogging the system, and I think corporate money is a big part of it.
Yeah. So what kind of response have you gotten from this report you guys have put out? And I hope folks will take a look at it over at greenpeace.org/USA. It's called the Climate Emergency Unpacked: How Consumer Goods Companies Are Fueling Big Oil's Plastic Expansion. That's at greenpeace.org/USA. Go through this with me a little bit. What kind of response are you getting?
It's been good. I mean, I think for a lot of these companies, it's been a huge wake-up call, because they like to position themselves as friendly, climate-friendly companies. You know, Coke doesn't put itself in the same category as an Exxon, and, you know, likes to believe they're going to exist long into the future. And so I think what we've accomplished with this is sort of reframing the conversation, looking much more at the source, talking about reuse and how they're going to really transition towards new business models. And so we've been pleased with that. You know, we're doing lots of shows and kind of just getting the message out there that plastics is a climate problem as well as a pollution problem in its own right. And so we need to start looking at systemic solutions.
So just so we're clear, we were not talking about, you know, having to drink out of our hands in the future, though.
Is it? Because I can do this.
I get some of my friends who go, oh, you tree huggers, you're all the same. You want us just standing around looking at each other and not having any economy. And that's not what you're talking about here.
No, not at all. And I mean, these things are compatible. And the dichotomy, this false dichotomy about environmental interest versus, you know, actually having economic, it's that is put forward by corporate America to keep us from making true progress, distributing wealth and building an environment that works for everyone and an economy that works for everyone. So don't believe that.
Yeah. So while you're the Global Plastics Project leader at Greenpeace, you're also a former labor guy like me, who wants people to have good family sustaining wage jobs with health care, with retirement security and with job security. And I don't think you want to put people out of work. I think you want people to live decent lives.
It's fundamental. I mean, when we talk about system redesign, it needs to start with the people who are working in these sectors and making sure that they can have jobs that can actually take care of their family, right? Yeah, all the things you just said. You know, we've watched corporate America just infiltrate the government in a way that has, you know, really been destructive for working class families. And, you know, it's just, it's egregious, and we're getting to a point where I feel like there's going to be energy, and we're going to start to see some change, because it's just gone too far.
So as a labor guy, any pushback from the labor folks on this? Because I know there are some people who do push back.
Yeah, no, and we haven't had any. You know, we work with the Teamsters, we work with UFCW, and we work with other unions. I mean, because at the end of the day, again, public interest, environmental interest, workers' rights, these are things that we share, and the values are there. And I think, you know, we're stronger together. And, you know, I've had a lot of progress working on both sides and both of these movements to build power.
Now, ultimately, the reality is if we're going to leave anything for our children worth having, we've got to probably start acting now and make sure that not only do they have jobs to have in the future, but also an environment that they'll want to live in anyway. But Graham, I appreciate the time, the work that you guys do. Good stuff. Hope folks will take a look at it. The Climate Emergency Unpacked: How Consumer Goods Companies Are Fueling Big Oil's Plastic Expansion. Greenpeace.org/USA. Graham, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick. You take good care. I love your show.
Thanks so much. Give me your thoughts. What do you think? Is it a good idea, bad idea? Do you recycle? I'd love to hear it. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the Delano grape strike began in California. The strike came a year after activists had forced Congress to end the Bracero contract labor program. The Filipino Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, led by Larry Itilong, Philip Vera Cruz, and others, called the strike against the Delano growers and the Coachella Valley grape growers. It had been a record harvest. Farm workers demanded higher wages, humane working conditions, and union recognition. When the growers refused, thousands walked out of the fields. A week later, the Mexican-American National Farm Workers Association, led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, joined the strike. It was a historic moment. Within a year, the two unions would merge to form the United Farm Workers. The union sent strikers to the Oakland docks to persuade the longshoremen not to load non-union grapes. Many of the Filipino workers in the San Joaquin Valley worked in the Alaska fish canneries organized by the ILWU in the off-season. And so the ILWU honored their union brothers' request. Thousands of cases of grapes were left to rot on the docks. This initial victory led Chavez to organize a grape boycott against heavyweights DiGiorgio and Shenley Industries. 6 months into the strike, union leaders marched 300 miles from Delano to Sacramento to bring attention to their struggle. They hoped to pressure growers to the negotiating table and legislators to act on their behalf. For 5 years, the strike and boycott continued with marches, organizing, and picket line arrests. Gradually, the UFW began winning higher wages, union recognition, and hiring halls. Finally, in 1970, a collective bargaining agreement covering 10,000 workers was reached. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Wells Fargo got slapped with a little bitty fine. They've agreed to pay $72.6 million to settle their overcharging and misleading of customers. Evidently, between 2010 and 2017, people who were doing some foreign exchange stuff, you know, you go in and say, hey, I'm going to this country, exchange my money for this money. Evidently, they were instructing the customer service people to, charge you a higher rate. And it's one of those little kind of cheaty, scammy things that you would expect a kid to do, you know, maybe working at a gas station. You wouldn't expect a massive financial institution to try and pull the wool over people's eyes. But evidently, what they were doing is, let's say you were purchasing a euro, and this is the example that they gave. And for $1, it would cost a $1.01, like 1.23 cents. So $1, 0.0123. What they would charge you is $1, 0.0213. So it'd be just a little tweak, just a little bit. I mean, literally fractions of a penny. But when you're talking about the kind of volume that they're talking about, it you know, brought in, you know, tens of millions of dollars in cheat fees. And, you know, they called it the big figure trick, I guess was one of the things. And if a savvy customer goes, hey, wait a second, that wasn't the right number, that math doesn't add up, they would simply go, oh, gee, must have been a typo, and then they'd correct it. And they got away with this for 7 years before some people filed a lawsuit. And the $72.6 million is going to be split between, I guess, half of the money is going to be the $35.3 million will go to 771 customers that I guess are the ones who figured out that they could go back and sue, the ones that they say were affected by the fraud. And then the rest of it, the 37.3, will go to the U.S. Treasury, I guess, because these are civil penalties that they have to pay for violating financial regulations. And I'm looking at this, I'm going, you know, almost $73 million sounds like a slap on the wrist. I would really like to know how much this scam actually brought in. And then for me, I would go, okay, let's go back and figure out how much it brought in. And then we triple the fine based on what you brought in so that you don't do it again. So that it's not just a little, oh, slap on the wrist. Well, don't do it again. Promise not to. Go post a notice. It's crazy. It's crazy times, I'm telling you. But the fact that they're going to walk out with that is kind of, well, predictable. Very, very predictable. Now remember, you know, Wells Fargo is the bank that got into a whole bunch of problems and a whole bunch of other, making up fake accounts, doing all kinds of things to fleece their members or their customers. But hey, it's corporate America, man. Here's some interesting news for TV buffs and film folks. We're on the brink of a estimated 60,000 television and film crew workers with IATSE, the International Alliance for Theatrical Stage Employees. They could go on strike starting on October 1st, as you have these crew members who work on union productions, both film and television, fighting for, you know, better wages, hours, conditions. Hours mostly. And this is one of those things where I go, you know, I've known for a long time, and I've known people who worked on film crews who tell of just the grueling hours. You're there 12, 14, 16 hours a day, every day during the shoot. And while the actors, you know, they have long days too, but it's the people who have to set up and then sit and wait for all of that stuff to happen and be on beck and call in case something goes wrong, and then stay afterwards to tear it all down and put it away. Those are the folks who are the ones behind the scenes. Those are the IATSE members. And what they're saying is, look, you know, it's we're coming out of this pandemic, and this is bad. We don't want to go back to the way things used to be. And this is, we're, I think, going to see a lot more of this stuff from people who used to, hey, this is just how it is. It's how it always is. The abuse that we're taking, we've taken over the years. It's part of the gig. It's what you have to put up with. I think they're kind of going to be interesting because, look, you know that they work in grueling hours, long hours, low wages, you know, all of this stuff. And because of the pandemic and what we've lived through, they're saying maybe enough is enough. So you could see, you know, union cinematographers, editors, makeup and hairstylists, writers, camera operators, all those folks. You could see Hollywood on strike come October 1st. So October 1st is going to be an interesting day. We could shut down the government and Hollywood could shut down because, as we're finding out, the film studios are racing to get things back out. Because you had that period where nothing was getting done. They want to catch up. And how do they do it? Well, they do it by exploiting their workforce. And these workers are saying, nope. Not going to do it. It'd be interesting to see how this plays out. In fact, we're going to work on getting some folks here on the program to talk about this in the coming days, because I think this kind of stuff is important. That people are finding their voice, they're finding commonality, they're organizing together, they're standing in solidarity, and they're saying, you know what, we want things to get better. That simple. I'm excited to see what happens. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
The storm's 150-mile-an-hour winds wreaked havoc on offshore oil production platforms, as well as onshore oil and gas processing plants.
Hurricane Ida's destruction caused a record number of oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico. Today's children face more climate disasters than their grandparents, new study warns. Plus,
11 felony charges and 20 misdemeanors. Charges include 4 homicides.
California utility PG&E charged in wildfire that killed 4.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
A new report says that animals are shape-shifting in response to the climate crisis. Same here. These aren't love handles, okay? Before the sea levels rise, I'm growing my own water wings.
I know the feeling. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, well, the Republicans in the Senate are trying to destroy the country and the global economy, basically, but they're also screwing over a bunch of natural disaster victims right now.
Yes, they are. On Monday, Senate Republicans blocked legislation to suspend the debt ceiling, which pays for spending already incurred, and to keep the government in operation, which also blocked emergency disaster aid for victims of Hurricane Ida.
Well done, Republicans.
Speaking of Hurricane Ida, NOAA reports that the deadly storm, which made a direct hit on Louisiana and caused billions of dollars in damages, also caused an unprecedented number of oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico. 55, a new record. The new analysis underscores the fragility of the oil industry's aging infrastructure on the Gulf Coast as hurricanes become more intense and extreme due to man-made global warming caused by the oil industry.
Ironic, ain't it?
Back to Congress, an intense time for President Joe Biden's climate agenda as Democratic congressional leaders work to feverishly forge a path forward with a handful of so-called moderate Democrats on Biden's Build Back Better Act reconciliation package as Republicans throw wrenches into the machinery. DeSmog Blog reports that the oil industry has launched an all-out pressure campaign to kill off a proposal by congressional Democrats to tax the industry for the first time for its methane leaks, an extremely powerful greenhouse gas, in order to fund climate programs.
And they don't like that for some reason?
They don't. And it matters, because a new study projects that even if countries fulfill their current pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions, children born in 2020 will, on average, endure 7 times more extreme heat waves and more than twice as many droughts over their lifetimes as their grandparents.
Wow.
Today's children will also see almost 3 times as many river floods and crop failures, and twice the number of wildfires as people born 60 years ago.
Sorry, kids. We tried.
And that is on average. Increases in exposure will be much higher in some countries. It's the first research to assess how climate extremes will affect different age groups and highlights the intergenerational injustice posed by the climate crisis.
Grim.
In other news, in Northern California, prosecutors have charged electric utility giant Pacific Gas and Electric with 4 counts of homicide and multiple other felonies for its role in causing the 2020 Zog fire near Redding, which killed 4 people and destroyed hundreds of homes.
Of course, no one will go to jail, even if they are found guilty. They have been charged before with manslaughter, and I cannot believe the state has not taken over PG&E at this point and put them out of our misery.
State fire investigators found the Zog fire was sparked by a dying tree that PG&E knew was dangerously close to its transmission lines. Here's Shasta County District Attorney Stephanie Bridget.
If you've got a known hazard that sits for 2 years, it's just not an accident. They knew it was there. They left it. They didn't remove it. And people died.
Last year, the company pleaded guilty to 84 counts of manslaughter over a 2018 blaze that destroyed the town of Paradise.
Why not? No one's going to jail.
But some good news.
Good.
In Germany, a good sign for climate policy after the country's center-left party, the Social Democrats, narrowly defeating retiring Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative party in federal elections, with the environmentalist Green Party coming in a very strong third. Here in the U.S., the Biden EPA has issued major rules to cut HFCs, greenhouse gases used in refrigeration that are hundreds of thousands of times more powerful than CO2. The new standards are widely backed by industry and will ultimately cut HFCs by 85% over the next 15 years. Finally, Norway has set a national target of 2025 to ban sales of new gasoline and diesel vehicles.
Wow.
But it turns out on its current trajectory, the country is on track to reach 100% electric vehicle sales as early as April.
Wow.
Yes.
Well done, Norway. It can be done. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm looking at what's going on down in Florida. And again, you know, the policies coming out of that place are just crazy. And I keep hoping that out of the insanity we see from the Ron DeSantis's and the Marco Rubio's and the rest of them, the Matt Gaetz's, that some sanity will eventually rise up. And maybe the Florida man will actually be a decent guy who has some thoughts of others. And maybe it's the next generation. And here to share some thoughts on what that could look like, a representative of Gen Z. I've asked Jack Cacciarella. I'm going to get it. Cacciarella to come talk with us. I got it right. He is the digital guy for Retire Marco and Remove Ron. He's also the co-host of Zoomed In podcast. Jack, thanks for taking time for us.
And thank you so much for having me on the show. I am so excited to be here. Really talk Florida and talk, you know, what needs to be fixed in Florida, because there's so much of it. We are the Sunshine State. We have a bright future, but that's not going to be under Republican leadership. So if we can make a couple of changes here and there, it's going to do our state well. And I know that we have a bright future ahead.
No, and I'm hopeful. I mean, I've been following you for a little while, and you know, the hope is that you take Florida man to the next step, because whenever we hear the man from Florida, it's always something really, really bad. So when I see you trying to grab that, I'm going, maybe we're going to start seeing some things that are really good.
Yeah, I always say that, you know, I'm not like Florida man. I am a man from Florida, though. I'm not maybe the alligator wrestling, running into a Walmart, you know, lighting things on fire. Those type of headlines that you usually see coming out of Florida sometimes that are attributed to that stereotype. But I'm a man from Florida, more focused on how we can better our state. And that's going to come. A lot of that is going to be in 2022. We have huge opportunities to take the next steps in showing how we want our state to be represented, whether that be at the state level in our local elections, whether that be given, you know, Ron DeSantis the boot that he deserves, or whether that be in saying goodbye to spineless Marco Rubio, showing that Floridians actually deserve some real representation, because there's a lot ahead for our state, and we can be extremely successful if we make that pivot now.
And ultimately, it's going to come down to your generation showing up next year. I mean, at the end of the day, we saw a reasonable turnout of the younger generation here in this last election, but the midterms always seem to be a little trickier. And with some of the craziness that we've seen recently, the hope is that your generation, who has some significant problems waiting for them down the road, start saying, maybe we start fixing some of this stuff now.
Yeah, and that's something that we can definitely see, maybe in Florida more so than another state. And something that I always assure everyone of is that elections in Florida are tight. In 2018, the margin of victory for Ron DeSantis was not as huge as you might think it was. About 40,000 votes there. And so if we see the turnout that I expect and my friends expect from Gen Z and other young people in Florida, we're looking at shrinking and then beating that small margin. Because in 2020, we saw the power of our voices. And right now we are seeing that our representatives will respond to us when we demand action. And that action can only be called for if we're showing up to vote and we're showing them why it is important that our voices be heard, because we will deliver for them as well. So I see great promise in how young people are going to be able to turn out in 2022 and just carry that energy also into 2024 and beyond as well, whether that be running for, you know, in local elections or organizing or having our voices heard in every way possible to make sure that what we want is front of mind for people running for office right now.
Yeah, we hear this a lot. You know, we're fighting for what we want, and a lot of people, you've got voices all over the political spectrum. But your generation, you know, what seems to be the issues that are front and foremost for you and your friends?
Yeah, and I think that when most people think of what Gen Z wants and what younger people want, they go directly to climate. And, you know, I think that's the right approach. But I think that we understand the way to be pragmatic in solving our problems. And we know that a stronger economy and a better future for our climate can go hand in hand. And we know that we can solve those issues in the same way. So we are willing to work with the conventional ideas of what policy, you know, maybe the Biden administration wants to be put in place, but bringing our ideas for what a better climate looks like and tying those together. So climate is usually what's going to be front of mind for us. But yeah, what we really want to focus on as well is protecting our ability to have our voices heard. So that's passing voting rights legislation as soon as possible to make sure that our elections are protected. Because although the 2020, we just saw this in Arizona, you know, although the 2020 election, GOP is trying to still relitigate that over and over again, what they're not trying to do is overturn 2020. What they want to do is overturn 2022. So that's where we want to be focused, saying that we see what you're trying to do. We're gonna call the bullshit. We know what's happening. This is in preparation for something else. We're not letting that happen. So we have our eyes not only focused on the future of our climate and of our planet, but the future of our elections, so we can make sure our voices are heard.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing about the Republicans is they don't try and hide anything. They're usually pretty right out in front. If they're going to steal
they'll
something,
they'll tell you.
They'll be happy to tell you. And look, this has been our problem for a long time. Democrats have not organized in the same ways. They haven't pushed in the same ways. And they've been too nice. I've said for too long, Democrats show up to a fight offering to hold somebody's coat and not willing to ball up their digits and roll around in the mud.
Yeah, and that's something that I do my best in trying to be part of that change, saying that we have been too kind in our messaging. We have been too timid in our messaging. We don't really want to necessarily brag about ourselves, but we should. And more so than just doing that, we need to be calling out the hypocrisy and the straight up lunacy of the GOP. So when Marco Rubio does something that's ridiculous, I'm happy to call him. I'm happy to call him on it. And I'm happy to, you know, maybe poke a little fun at him in the process. I'll throw up an image of Marco next to a jellyfish because it's true. The man is spineless. And I don't care about saying that because it's true. And sometimes when we put these elected officials on pedestals and they want to be treated as kings and queens, it's okay to knock them down a little bit with a little bit of satire. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah, it's not just okay, Jack. It's not just okay. It's mandatory because politicians aren't kings and queens. They're tools to get the things that we need done.
And that's how we need to be viewing these things. These are our representatives. If they're not representing us, then things need to change. They can be defeated if that's what we want. And I think that's a point that we need to make infinitely clear, that these things don't have to be like systemic. We don't have to have this rut in Florida specifically, where we've had, you know, 2 decades of Republican leadership in Tallahassee. Like, these things can change and we can make our state better.
Yeah. Now, you do this fantastic podcast, you and another person, another co-host, the Zoomed In podcast, and good stuff. I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, to this point, what do you think of the Biden administration, what they've done thus far, any stumbles you see, anything that you've thought wanted differently?
So what I see right now is that there is probably a bit too much of playing into the perceived politics that a Kyrsten Sinema or Joe Manchin would want. I think giving a little bit too much in the hand of saying this is sort of fake bipartisanship a lot of the times is what's happening when Republicans want to act like they're coming to the table, but they're not. Look at the police reform talks that just fell apart with Senator Cory Booker and Tim Scott. You know, Cory Booker was coming to the table. The Democrats were coming to the table. They wanted actual change. Republicans did.
Right.
They have no incentive to do anything. It's clear. It's come down from the top from Mitch McConnell saying that I do not want to help Joe Biden. I would rather see a global economic collapse than Joe Biden have a victory. They have zero incentive to do anything.
Right. And we saw that back during the Obama term where they came out and said, we're going to make him a one-term president. You had Limbaugh, the titular head of the party, saying, I hope he fails. These are scorched earth people. And look at right now,
the current
talk of another government shutdown during a pandemic when the economy's struggling to move along. And they want to throw a wrench into this because they believe in scorched earth. And again, Democrats don't. And that's how they end up getting, you know, put in these positions.
The only time that we've seen Republicans actually try to be a part of the process of governing was with the Biden infrastructure bill, right? 19 Republicans voted yes on that. Marco Rubio was not one of them, of course, because he refuses to do anything or ever show up and do his job. But 19 Republicans voted yes. Now, that wasn't a moment of bipartisanship. That was a moment for some Republicans to be able to point to and say, hey, if you give us the keys, we can govern. But they can't. And they've clearly shown in all other instances that they can't. And so I think we maybe need to spend a little bit less time with, you know, I believe that there can be compromise. I don't think there can be necessarily compromise all that much with this current iteration of the GOP. And I think there needs to be a little bit more focus. And I think that's going to be coming in the next couple of days from President Biden and you know, getting into those discussions with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. I know they've had meetings where they come to the White House and they talk things out. And I think that can lead to substantial change in actually making something happen. So I think a little bit more presence by the president would be helpful. But with what the administration has currently done, I think they have been successful and I think they will continue to be successful. But I think they just need to be ready to strong arm a couple of representatives into doing what the country wants, right? If you have a politically popular agenda and you were elected to pass it, then you need to pass it, right? This is what people want. And I think they should be making that infinitely clear with their messaging and how they communicate to other members of the party.
Yeah, but Jack, I mean, there are things that are infinitely popular all the time that never see the light of day because the moneyed interest in this country and make sure it never sees the light of day. Most of this Build Back Better plan, overwhelming majorities of the population want, see as something that we need. This is almost a 40-year reset, in my view, of some of the bad policies that got us to this point. But yet you've got someone like Joe Manchin, who I do believe down the road will vote for something. He wants his attention. And like, you know, like a child who probably wasn't breastfed enough, he needs his attention. Sinema, I don't know. I think there's some other problems there where I think she would be willing to blow up the whole thing.
I know. So obviously she's trying to brand herself in some way, right? She wants a brand as.
Yeah. I don't know if crazy is a good brand,
but I don't know what the brand is. Like, is the brand, I am Democratic Mitch. Like, am I the Democrat Mitch McConnell? Like, I don't know what the brand is. And not only you obviously have loud critics on the left saying, this is like, what are you doing? But you also have the state party in Arizona saying, if you blow up this bill, there will be consequences. Like, that is your state party. Going back to what I said about representing the people who sent you there, that's your party being explicitly clear and saying, this is what we want. Let's go and make it happen. There are 50 Democrats. We can pass this thing. It's tremendously popular. Not only, let's put aside like the political popularity and let's talk about how successful this will be in making the lives of the working people in America better. Like, let's focus on that.
Yeah.
Let's step aside from this poll says 66% popularity. This poll says 72% or 63%. It'll make people's lives better. Like, let's talk about that, Kyrsten Sinema. It'll make people's lives better. So do you want to step up and do that? Do you want to do what you were sent to do? Like, what is the deal? What is branding yourself as someone who's like potentially going to lose a primary more important than actually helping people? I honestly don't know what she's doing.
No, but the weird thing is, you know, I look at Manchin, I look at Sinema, and I know that there are others behind them that are causing little fires to be set all around as well. And I don't give them a pass either. But at least I hope that Biden will be able to pull them in. Sinema is the wild card in all this. And is it your view, like I believe, that if we don't get anything, if we don't get the at least something for the Build Back Better plan, and I'm of the mindset you take $1.5 trillion if you can get it, just to get it passed through and put into law. If we don't get either, I think 2022 is going to be a really long year.
I don't necessarily think that if we pass all of this incredible legislation, it means that we're set in golden for 2022.
Nope. No.
There's still a lot of work to be done. We still have to continue to be successful. We still have to pass sweeping voting rights legislation. There's a lot of work to do. But if we don't pass anything, it will be a massive failure. And I don't necessarily see how we recover from that. I just don't.
Because where I wanted to go with this is, obviously, you know, you're more in tune with Generation Z than I am. And I'm really curious of where the mindset is going, because if we don't get voting rights, put into law, if we don't pass something to address what you said is the number one issue, climate change, do you guys just stay home? Do you say, you know, hey, 2020 was the year we were supposed to solve this. We gave you what you needed. You didn't do anything. We're going to go elsewhere.
Well, this goes to a discussion that I think is going to continue to happen, is going to pick up soon, which is, how do we brand the midterms? Do we say this is preventing more crazy GOP, a little bit of what happened in California? Like, this could, Larry Elder could be your governor. You cannot possibly have that. So do you want to talk about more of the nutso crazy Boebert, Cawthorn, Greens, or do you want to say, look how successful we've been, right? You got to do both, but which one is more of a winning political strategy? You know, you could potentially say it's look at our successes, but if we don't have any successes, then we can't run on that message. So I'm not sure that it necessarily ensures that young people won't turn out in the numbers that I expect them to, but it doesn't do us any favors. I can guarantee that. And I think progressives may start to get a little tired of giving up what they want for the sake of compromise when they know what they want is not only popular, but will be successful in helping Americans everywhere. I think there's going to be a little bit of we're tired of giving up what we want. And I think that is very damaging for the party.
Yeah, ultimately, the messaging of, well, we didn't get anything done because we didn't have enough votes, I don't know is going to fly this time around. We'll see. I'm hoping. I'm still being told by my sources that we're going to get both bills pushed through eventually. It's not going to be $3.5 trillion, but it's not going to be $1 trillion either. And I'm of the mindset you take what you can get moving, and then you build on into the future. But I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, I think there has been some. I think at least coming from the White House, there's been some optimism that maybe it's not going to be this week, but next week, all the cards can fall into place and we can move forward. Maybe there will be a compromise. But the biggest issue here, when we're talking about a compromise, is a compromise on what? Is it a compromise on like the actual substance of the bill, or is it a compromise on the price tag? Because I think that's more what Joe Manchin is worried about, less of where the money's going and just what the money is. Like, I think he wants just a smaller bill, but doesn't really want to tell us what's in the bill,
yeah,
which makes this whole discussion more difficult.
No, I completely agree with you.
Want.
I completely agree. It's that pretending they care about fiscal responsibility when the reality is we allow the wealth class of this country to walk away with untold fortunes that we don't even consider. Yet we can't get the pothole filled out in front of my house.
Yeah.
Kids can't get, an education. It's crazy stuff. But obviously something we're going to continue to talk about in the coming weeks and months. It was great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts with us in the future.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much for having me on. It's great.
Keep up the great work there on the Zoomed In podcast. I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out on social media how you can check that out. You can check out Jack Cacciarella and the Zoomed In podcast. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. The talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. Would you be willing to stand up in solidarity with your fellow workers, even if it cost you your job? Well, on this day in labor history, the workers at Mersey Docks and Harbour Company in Liverpool, England, answered that question. The year was 1995. 329 Mersey Dock workers refused to cross a picket line that was being walked against another company on the docks. The workers at Torside had been fired for protesting against erosions in job security and increasingly unpredictable scheduling. They were speaking out against the casualization of their labor. When the Mersey dock workers would not cross the Torside picket line, they too were fired.
Dock workers across the world stood up in solidarity with the Mersey workers against this unjust treatment. They knew if it could happen in Liverpool, it might happen anywhere. Pickets sprung up from Norway to Japan, from Australia to Italy, and into the United States. It was a global outpouring of solidarity. The strike wore on for 850 days. 1 year into the strike, dock workers held an International Day of Action in support of the Liverpool workers. Finally, 2.5 years after they were fired, the dock workers agreed to a settlement. They did not get their jobs back, but they did get severance pay. A film was made about the struggle. The proceeds were used to purchase a bar in Liverpool. It is known as the Dockers Pub and has become a space for working class organizing. The International Dock Workers Council was also born from this strike. Today, the council has 90,000 members, a lasting movement of solidarity. 20 years after the strike, dock workers from across the world gathered in Liverpool to remember the struggle.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, this CEO, and we've talked about this guy before. His name is Dan Price. He's the guy you may remember a number of years ago, and it's been several years, who said he's not going to pay any of his employees less than $70,000 a year. And he's hired a bunch of people, and everyone said, your company's going to go down the tubes. You're done. You're going to be out of business. Well, actually, his company has thrived. And he said, look, I'd rather hire somebody with a couple years experience than somebody with college. I want people who are passionate. I want people who are willing to work. And I'm going to pay them well. And it's this kind of mindset that I find we need more of our CEO class. And so he tweeted out today something I found quite interesting. He pointed out that the CEOs of like Chipotle, who made $38 million last year, or Burger King and who made $20 million, or Starbucks, who made over $14 million, or down the list of all of these fast food restaurants and the millions of dollars that their CEOs are being paid. He says, but yes, your order costs more because of the $1 an hour raise that the workers got. And I thought that was the right messaging. Look, so much of what's going on in this country has been the wealth class sucking, just sucking out the wealth right out from under us, and then making us blame each other for the fact that you know, inflation's happening, costs are going up. It's just one of those things that I saw that I had to point it out. It's infuriating. Now, the folks over at the Economic Policy Institute, EPI, they've done a report. They say that if the minimum wage were to increase to $15 an hour, if we increase the federal minimum wage by 2025, it's, you know, still a couple years down the road, that pay increase would be, the number was, it was staggering. Nearly 2 million direct care workers would see an increase in their wages. Nearly 50% of the people who take care of our most vulnerable. And, you know, over the weekend, you know, we do our call-in show on WBAI in New York City. We had a woman call in and say, look, you know, I can't get at my home health aid. She was blind. She, you know, they send her to a freaking website. You go, but she's blind, you morons, because you didn't have a code. And all these obstacles and these hurdles. And you know, just trying to get somebody to come help read her mail, come help do things to help her. And yet we have these obstacles. And the wages that the workers are making are basically poverty wages. So they're saying, look, if we could bump that up, you'd have almost 2 million of these people who take care of our most vulnerable being able to support themselves, getting a little bit of bump, being able to make ends meet. And yet here we are in this weird kind of space where the sad reality is, as they point out, more than 5 out of every 6 direct care workers would have higher take-home pay in 9 states. Places like Mississippi, where 90% of the home health care workers would make more because the wages are set that low. And you look at this and you go, yeah, they're all no rights at work states. They're all the states that don't allow workers to unionize and fight them at every turn when they do. I think there's a message there. I think there's something there. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Make sure you follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow. Give us a like over on Facebook. Subscribe over on YouTube. Lots of ways to get a hold of the program. Also, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Make sure you send us that email. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.